and off took it from him and poured out the champagne. Another bottle, Mitya cried to the innkeeper, and forgetting to clink glasses with the Pole, whom he had so solemnly invited to drink to their good understanding, he drank off his glass without waiting for anyone else. His whole countenance suddenly changed. The solemn and tragic expression with which he'd entered vanished completely, and a look of something childlike came into his face. He seemed to have become suddenly gentle and subdued. He looked shyly and happily at everyone, with a continual, nervous little laugh, and the blissful expression of a dog who had done wrong, been punished, and forgiven. He seemed to have forgotten everything, and was looking round at everyone with a childlike smile of delight. He looked at Grushenka, laughing continually, and bringing his chair close up to her. By degrees he had gained some idea of the two Poles, though he'd formed no definite conception of them yet. The Pole on the sofa struck him by his dignified demeanour and his Polish accent, and above all by his pipe. "Well, what of it? It's a good thing he's smoking a pipe," he reflected. The Pole's puffy, middle-aged face, with its tiny nose, and two very thin, pointed, dyed, and impudent-looking moustaches, had not so far roused the faintest doubts in Mitya. He was not even particularly struck by the Pole's absurd wig made in Siberia, with love locks foolishly combed forward over the temples. "I suppose it's all right since he wears a wig," he went on, musing blissfully. The other, younger Pole, who was staring insolently and defiantly at the company and listening to the conversation with silent contempt, still only impressed Mitya by his great height, which was in striking contrast to the Pole on the sofa. "If he stood up, he'd be 6'3". The thought flitted through Mitya's mind. It occurred to him, too, that this Pole must be the friend of the other, as it were, a bodyguard, and no doubt the big Pole was at the disposal of the little Pole with a pipe. But this all seemed to Mitya perfectly right and not to be questioned. In his mood of dog-like submissiveness, all feeling of rivalry had died away. Grushenka's mood and the enigmatic tone of some of her words he completely failed to grasp. All he understood with thrilling heart was that she was kind to him, that she had forgiven him and made him sit by her. He was beside himself with delight, watching her sip her glass of champagne. The silence of the company seemed somehow to strike him, however, and he looked round at everyone with expectant eyes. "Why are we sitting here, though, gentlemen? Why don't you begin doing something?" his smiling eyes seemed to ask. "He keeps talking nonsense, and we were all laughing," Kalganov began suddenly, as though divining his thoughts, and pointing to Maximov. Mitya immediately stared at Kalganov and then at Maximov. "He's talking nonsense?" he laughed, his short, wooden laugh, seeming suddenly delighted at something. "Ha! Ha! Ha! Yes, would you believe it? He will have it that all our cavalry officers in the 20s married Polish women. That's awful rot, isn't it?" "Polish women?" repeated Mitya, perfectly ecstatic. Kalganov was well aware of Mitya's attitude to Grushenka, and he guessed about the Pole, too. But that did not much interest him, perhaps did not interest him at all. What he was interested in was Maximov. He had come here with Maximov by chance, and he met the Poles here at the inn for the first time in his life. Grushenka he knew before, and had once been with someone to see her, but she had not taken to him. But here she looked at him very affectionately. Before Mitya's arrival she had been making much of him, but he seemed somehow to be unmoved by it. He was a boy, not over 20, dressed like a dandy, with a very charming, fair-skinned face, and splendid, thick, fair hair. From his fair face looked out beautiful pale blue eyes, with an intelligent and sometimes even deep expression, beyond his age indeed, although the young man sometimes looked and talked quite like a child, and was not at all ashamed of it, even when he was aware of it himself. As a rule he was very willful, even capricious, though always friendly. Sometimes there was something fixed and obstinate in his expression. He would look at you and listen, seeming all the while to be persistently dreaming over something else. Often he was listless and lazy, at other times he would grow excited, sometimes apparently over the most trivial matters. "Only imagine I've been taking about with me for the last 4 days," he went on, indolently drawling his words, quite naturally, though without the slightest affectation. Ever since your brother, do you remember, shoved him off the carriage and sent him flying? That made me take an interest in him at the time, and I took him into the country. But he keeps talking such rot, I'm ashamed to be with him. I'm taking him back.
The gentleman has not seen Polish ladies and says what is impossible,
the Pole with the pipe observed to Maximov. He spoke Russian fairly well, much better anyway than he pretended. If he used Russian words, he always distorted them into a Polish form.
But I was married to a Polish lady myself,
tittered Maximov.
But did you serve in the cavalry? You were talking about the cavalry. Were you a cavalry officer?
Put in Kalganov at once.
Was he a cavalry officer indeed? Ha, ha,
cried Mitya, listening eagerly, and turning his inquiring eyes to each as he spoke, as though there were no knowing what he might hear from each.
No, you see, Maximov turned to him. What I mean is that those pretty Polish ladies, when they dance the mazurka with our Uhlans, when one of them dances a mazurka with a Uhlan, she jumps on his knee like a kitten, a little white one. And the Pan father and Pan mother look on and allow it. They allow it. And next day the Uhlan comes and offers her his hand. That's how it is. Offers her his hand.
Maximov ended tittering.
The Pan is a Ladjdek.
The tall Pole on the chair growled suddenly and crossed one leg over the other. Mitya's eye was caught by his huge greased boot with its thick, dirty sole. The dress of both the Poles looked rather greasy.
"Well, now it's Ladjdek. What's he scolding about?"
said Grushenka, suddenly vexed.
"Pani Agrippina, what the gentleman saw in Poland were servant girls and not ladies of good birth,"
the Pole with the pipe observed to Grushenka.
"You can reckon on that,"
the tall Pole snapped contemptuously.
"What next? Let him talk. People talk, why hinder them? It makes it cheerful,"
Grushenka said crossly.
"I'm not hindering them, Pani,"
said the Pole in the wig with a long look at Grushenka, and relapsing into dignified silence, he sucked his pipe again.
"No, no, the Polish gentleman spoke the truth."
Kalganov got excited again, as though it were a question of vast import. "He's never been in Poland, so how can he talk about it? I suppose you weren't married in Poland, were you?"
"No, in the province of Smolensk. Only a Uhlan had brought her to Russia before that, my future wife, with her mama and her aunt and another female relation with a grown-up son. He brought her straight from Poland and gave her up to me. He was a lieutenant in our regiment, a very nice young man. At first he meant to marry her himself, but he didn't marry her because she turned out to be lame."
"So you married a lame woman?"
cried Kalganov.
"Yes, they both deceived me a little bit at the time and concealed it. I thought she was hopping. She kept hopping. I thought it was for fun."
"So pleased she was going to marry you!"
yelled Kalganov in a ringing, childish voice.
"Yes, so pleased, but it turned out to be quite a different cause. Afterwards, when we were married, after the wedding, that very evening, she confessed, and very touchingly asked forgiveness. I once jumped over a puddle when I was a child, she said, and injured my leg!"
Kalganov went off into the most childish laughter, almost falling on the sofa. Grushenka, too, laughed. Mitya was at the pinnacle of happiness.
"Do you know that's the truth? He's not lying now!"
exclaimed Kalganov, turning to Mitya.
"And do you know he's been married twice? It's his first wife he's talking about. But his second wife, do you know, ran away and is alive now."
"Is it possible?"
said Mitya, turning quickly to Maximov with an expression of the utmost astonishment.
"Yes, she did run away. I've had that unpleasant experience,"
Maximov modestly assented.
"With a monsieur, and what was worse, she'd had all my little property transferred to her beforehand. You're an educated man, she said to me, you can always get your living. She settled my business with that. A venerable bishop once said to me, 'One of your wives was lame, but the other was too light-footed.'"
"Listen, listen," cried Kalganov, bubbling over.
"If he's telling lies, and he often is, he's only doing it to amuse us all. There's no harm in that, is there? You know, I sometimes like him. He's awfully low. But it's natural to him, eh? Don't you think so? Some people are low from self-interest, but he's simply so from nature. Only fancy, he claims..." He was arguing about it all the way yesterday. "That Gogol wrote Dead Souls about him. Do you remember there's a landowner called Maximov in it, whom Nozdryov thrashed? He was charged, you remember, for inflicting bodily injury with rods on the landowner Maximov in a drunken condition.
Would you believe it? He claims that he was that Maximov, and that he was beaten. Now, can it be so? Chichikov made his journey at the very latest at the beginning of the 20s, so that the dates don't fit. He couldn't have been thrashed then. He couldn't, could he?
It was difficult to imagine what Kalganov was excited about, but his excitement was genuine. Mitya followed his lead without protest.
"Well, but if they did thrash him," he cried, laughing.
"It is not that they thrashed me exactly, but what I mean is," put in Maximov.
"What do you mean? Either they thrashed you or they didn't."
"What o'clock is it, panie?"
the Pole with the pipe asked his tall friend with a bored expression. The other shrugged his shoulders in reply. Neither of them had a watch.
"Why not talk? Let other people talk. Mustn't other people talk because you're bored?"
Grushenka flew at him with evident intention of finding fault. Something seemed for the first time to flash upon Mitya's mind. This time the Pole answered with unmistakable irritability.
"Panie, I didn't oppose it. I didn't say anything."
"All right, then. Come, tell us your story,"
Grushenka cried to Maximov. "Why are you all so silent?"
"There's nothing to tell. It's all so foolish,"
answered Maximov at once with evident satisfaction, mincing a little.
"Besides, all that's by way of allegory, and Gogol, for he's made all the names have a meaning. Nostryov was really called Nosov, and Kuvshinikov had quite a different name. He was called Shkvornev. Fenardi really was called Fenardi, only he wasn't an Italian but a Russian. And Mamselle Fenardi was a pretty girl with her pretty little legs in tights, and she had a little short skirt with spangles, and she kept turning round and round, only not for 4 hours, but for 4 minutes only, and she bewitched everyone."
"But what were you beaten for?" cried Kalganov.
"For Piron," answered Maximov.
"What Piron?" cried Mitya.
"The famous French writer Piron. We were all drinking then, a big party of us in a tavern at that very fair. They'd invited me, and first of all I began quoting epigrams. Is that you, Boileau? What a funny get-up. And Boileau answers that he's going to a masquerade. That is to the baths. And they took it to themselves, so I made haste to repeat another very sarcastic, well-known to all educated people. Yes, Sappho and Phaon are we. But one grief is weighing on me. You don't know your way to the sea." They were still more offended, and began abusing me in the most unseemly way for it. And, as ill luck would have it, to set things right, I began telling a very cultivated anecdote about Piron, how he was not accepted into the French Academy, and to revenge himself wrote his own epitaph, "Si j'ai Piron qui ne fut rien, pas même académicien." They seized me and thrashed me. But for what? What for?
For my education. People can't thrash a man for anything,
Maximov concluded briefly and sententiously.
"Hey, that's enough. That's all stupid. I don't want to listen. I thought it would be amusing."
Grushenka cut them short suddenly. Mitya started, and at once left off laughing. The tall Pole rose upon his feet, and, with the haughty air of a man bored and out of his element, began pacing from corner to corner of the room, his hands behind his back.
"Ah, he can't sit still,"
said Grushenka, looking at him contemptuously. Mitya began to feel anxious. He noticed, besides, that the Pole on the sofa was looking at him with an irritable expression.
"Panie," cried Mitya, "let's drink, and the other pan, too, let's drink."
In a flash he'd pulled three glasses towards him and filled them with champagne.
"To Poland, Panovie, I drink to your Poland," cried Mitya. "I shall be delighted, Panie," said the Pole on the sofa with dignity and affable condescension, and he took his glass.
"And the other pan, what's his name? Drink, most illustrious, take your glass,"
Mitya urged.
"Pan Wroblewski,"
put in the Pole on the sofa. Pan Wroblewski came up to the table, swaying as he walked.
"To Poland, Panowie,"
cried Mitya, raising his glass.
"Hurrah!"
All three drank. Mitya seized the bottle and again poured out three glasses.
"Now to Russia, Panowie, and let us be brothers."
"Pour out some for us," said Grushenka. "I'll drink to Russia, too."
"So will I," said Kalganov.
"And I would, too, to Russia, the old grandmother,"
tittered Maximov.
Oh, cried Mitya. "Trifon Borisovich, some more bottles."
The other three bottles Mitya had brought with him were put on the table. Mitya filled the glasses.
"To Russia, hurrah!"
he shouted again. All drank the toast except the Poles, and Grushenka tossed off her whole glass at once. The Poles did not touch theirs.
"How's this, Panovia?" cried Mitya. "Won't you drink it?"
Pan Vrublevsky took the glass, raised it, and said with a resonant voice,
"To Russia, as she was before 1772. "Come, that's better,"
cried the other Pole, and they both emptied their glasses at once.
"You're fools, you Panovia!"
broke suddenly from Mitya.
"Panie!"
shouted both the Poles, menacingly setting on Mitya like a couple of cocks. Pan Vrublevsky was specially furious.
"Can one help loving one's own country?"
he shouted.
"Be silent, don't quarrel, I won't have any quarrelling,"
cried Grushenka imperiously, and she stamped her foot on the floor. Her face glowed, her eyes were shining. The effects of the glass she had just drunk were apparent. Mitya was terribly alarmed.
"Panovia, forgive me, it was my fault, I'm sorry. Vrublevsky, Panie Vrublevsky, I'm sorry."
"Hold your tongue, you, anyway. Sit down, you stupid."
Grushenka scolded with angry annoyance. Everyone sat down, all were silent, looking at one another.
"Gentlemen, I was the cause of it all,"
Mitya began again, unable to make anything of Grushenka's words.
"Come, why are we sitting here? What should we do to amuse ourselves again?"
"Ah, it's certainly anything but amusing,"
Kalganov mumbled lazily.
"Let's play faro again as we did just now,"
Maximov tittered suddenly.
"Faro? Splendid," cried Mitya.
"If only the Panovia."
"It's light, Panovia,"
the Pole on the sofa responded, as it were unwillingly.
"That's true,"
assented Pan Vrublevsky.
"Light? What do you mean by light?"
asked Grushenka.
"Late, Panie, a late hour, I mean,"
the Pole on the sofa explained.
"It's always late with them, they can never do anything."
Grushenka almost shrieked in her anger.
"They're dull themselves, say they want others to be dull. Before you came, Mitya, they were just as silent, kept turning up their noses at me."
"My goodness," cried the Pole on the sofa, "I see you're not well disposed to me, that's why I'm gloomy. I'm ready, Panie,"
added he, addressing Mitya.
"Begin, Panie,"
Mitya assented, pulling his notes out of his pocket and laying 200-ruble notes on the table.
"I want to lose a lot to you. Take your cards, make the bank."
"We'll have cards from the landlord, Panie,"
said the little Pole, gravely and emphatically.
"That's much the best way,"
chimed in Pan Vrublevsky.
"From the landlord? Very good, I understand. Let's get them from him. Cards!"
Mitya shouted to the landlord. The landlord brought in a new, unopened pack, and informed Mitya that the girls were getting ready, and that the Jews with the symbols would most likely be here soon. But the cart with the provisions had not yet arrived. Mitya jumped up from the table and ran into the next room to give orders. But only three girls had arrived, and Maria was not there yet, and he did not know himself what orders to give and why he'd run out. He only told them to take out of the box the presents for the girls, the sweets, the toffee, and the fondants.
"And vodka for André! Vodka for André!"
he cried in haste.
"I was rude to André."
Suddenly Maximov, who had followed him out, touched him on the shoulder.
"Give me 5 rubles, he whispered to Mitya. "I'll stake something at faro, too.
Capital, splendid. Take 10, here."
Again he took all the notes out of his pocket and picked out 1 for 10 rubles.
"And if you lose that, come again. Come again."
"Very good,"
Maximov whispered joyfully, and he ran back again. Mitya, too, returned, apologizing for having kept them waiting. The Poles had already sat down and opened the pack. They looked much more amiable, almost cordial. The Pole on the sofa had lighted another pipe and was preparing to throw. He wore an air of solemnity.
"To your places, gentlemen," cried Pan Vrublevsky.
"No, I'm not going to play any more," observed Kalganov. "I've lost 50 rubles to them just now."
"The Pan had no luck. Perhaps he'll be lucky this time,"
the Pole on the sofa observed in his direction.
"How much in the bank to correspond?"
asked Mitya.
"That's according, Panie, maybe 100, maybe 200, as much as you will stake."
"1 million,
laughed Mitya.
"The Pan captain has heard of Pan Podvysotsky, perhaps."
"What Podvysotsky?"
"In Warsaw there was a bank, and anyone comes and stakes against it.
Pod Vysotsky comes, sees 1,000 gold pieces, stakes against the bank. The banker says, "Panie Pod Vysotsky, are you laying down the gold, or must we trust to your honor?" "To my honor, Panie," says Pod Vysotsky, "so much the better." The banker throws the dice. Pod Vysotsky wins. "Take it, Panie," says the banker, and pulling out the drawer, he gives him 1,000,000. "Take it, Panie, this is your gain." There was 1,000,000 in the bank. "I didn't know that," says Pod Vysotsky. "Panie Pod Vysotsky," said the banker, "you pledged your honor and we pledged ours." Pod Vysotsky took the 1,000,000.
"That's not true," said Kalganov.
"Panie Kalganov, in gentlemanly society one doesn't say such things." "As if a Polish gambler would give away 1,000,000, cried Mitya, but checked himself at once. "Forgive me, Panie, it's my fault again. He would give away 1,000,000 for honor, for Polish honor. You see how I talk Polish? Here, I stake 10 rubles, the knave leads."
"And I put a ruble on the queen of hearts, the pretty little Panianochka, he,
laughed Maximov, pulling out his queen, and as though trying to conceal it from everyone, he moved right up and crossed himself hurriedly under the table. Mitya won. The ruble won, too.
"A corner," cried Mitya. "I'll bet another ruble, a single stake,"
Maximov muttered gleefully, hugely delighted at having won a ruble.
"Lost," shouted Mitya. "A double on the 7.
The 7, too, was trumped. "Stop!" cried Kalganov suddenly.
"Double! Double!"
Mitya doubled his stakes, and each time he doubled the stake, the card he doubled was trumped by the Poles. The ruble stakes kept winning.
"On the double!"
shouted Mitya furiously.
"You've lost 200, Panie. Will you stake another 100?
The Pole on the sofa inquired.
"What, lost 200 already? Then another 200, all doubles."
And pulling his money out of his pocket, Mitya was about to fling 200 rubles on the queen, but Kalganov covered it with his hand.
"That's enough,"
he shouted in his ringing voice.
"What's the matter?"
Mitya stared at him.
"That's enough. I don't want you to play any more. Don't."
"Why?"
"Because I don't. Hang it, come away, that's why. I won't let you go on playing."
Mitya gazed at him in astonishment.
"Give it up, Mitya, he may be right. You've lost a lot as it is,"
said Grushenka with a curious note in her voice. Both the Poles rose from their seats with a deeply offended air.
"Are you joking, Panie?"
said the short man, looking severely at Kalganov.
"How dare you?"
Pan Vrublevsky, too, growled at Kalganov.
"Don't dare to shout like that," cried Grushenka. "Ah, you turkey cocks!"
Mitya looked at each of them in turn, but something in Grushenka's face suddenly struck him, and at the same instant something new flashed into his mind, a strange new thought.
"Pani Agrippina,"
the little Pole was beginning, crimson with anger, when Mitya suddenly went up to him and slapped him on the shoulder.
"Most illustrious, 2 words with you. What do you want? In the next room I have 2 words to say to you, something pleasant. Very pleasant, you'll be glad to hear it."
The little pan was taken aback and looked apprehensively at Mitya. He agreed at once, however, on condition that Pan Vrublevsky went with them.
"The bodyguard, let him come, and I want him too, I must have him," cried Mitya. "March, Panovye."
"Where are you going?"
asked Grushenka anxiously.
"We'll be back in 1 moment,"
answered Mitya. There was a sort of boldness, a sudden confidence shining in his eyes. His face had looked very different when he entered the room an hour before. He led the Poles, not into the large room where the chorus of girls was assembling and the table was being laid, but into the bedroom on the right, where the trunks and packages were kept, and there were 2 large beds with pyramids of cotton pillows on each. There was a lighted candle on a small deal table in the corner. The small man and Mitya sat down to this table, facing each other, while the huge Vrublevsky stood beside them, his hands behind his back. The Poles looked severe, but were evidently inquisitive.
"What can I do for you, Panie?"
lisped the little Pole.
"Well, look here, Panie, I won't keep you long. There's money for you."
He pulled out his notes.
"Would you like 3,000? Take it and go your way."
The Pole gazed open-eyed at Mitya with a searching look.
3,000, panie.
He exchanged glances with Vrublevsky.
3, panovie, 3. Listen, panie, I see you're a sensible man. Take 3,000 and go to the devil. And Vrublevsky with you, do you hear? But at once, this very minute and forever. You understand that, panie, forever. Here's the door. You go out of it. What have you got there? A great coat, a fur coat, I'll bring it out to you. They'll get the horses out directly, and then goodbye, panie.
Mitya awaited an answer with assurance. He had no doubts. An expression of extraordinary resolution passed over the Pole's face.
And the money, panie?
The money, panie. 500 rubles I'll give you this moment for the journey, and as a first instalment. And 2,500 tomorrow in the town. I swear on my honour I'll get it. I'll get it at any cost, cried Mitya. The Poles exchanged glances again. The short man's face looked more forbidding.
700, not 500, at once, this minute, cash down.
Mitya added, feeling something wrong.
What's the matter, panie, don't you trust me? I can't give you the whole 3,000 straight off. If I give it, you may come back to her tomorrow. Besides, I haven't the 3,000 with me. I've got it at home in the town,
faltered Mitya, his spirit sinking at every word he uttered.
Upon my word, the money's there, hidden.
In an instant, an extraordinary sense of personal dignity showed itself in the little man's face.
What next? He asked ironically. For shame!
And he spat on the floor. Pan Vrublevsky spat too.
You do that, panie,
said Mitya, recognizing with despair that all was over.
Because you hope to make more out of Grushenka? You're a couple of capons, that's what you are. This is a mortal insult.
The little Pole turned as red as a crab, and he went out of the room briskly, as though unwilling to hear another word. Vrublevsky swung out after him, and Mitya followed, confused and crestfallen. He was afraid of Grushenka, afraid that the Pan would at once raise an outcry. And so indeed he did. The Pole walked into the room and threw himself in a theatrical attitude before Grushenka.
Pani Agrippina, I've received a mortal insult, he exclaimed.
But Grushenka suddenly lost all patience, as though they'd wounded her in the tenderest spot.
Speak Russian, she cried. Not another word of Polish. You used to talk Russian. You can't have forgotten it in 5 years.
She was red with passion.
Pani Agrippina,
my name's Agrafena Grushenka. Speak Russian, or I won't listen.
The Pole gasped with offended dignity and quickly and pompously delivered himself in broken Russian.
Pani Agrafena, I came here to forget the past and forgive it, to forget all that has happened till today.
Forgive? Come here to forgive me?
Grushenka cut him short, jumping up from her seat.
Just so, Pani. I'm not pusillanimous. I'm magnanimous. But I was astounded when I saw your lovers. Pan Mitya offered me 3,000 in the other room to depart. I spat in the Pan's face.
What? He offered you money for me?
Cried Grushenka hysterically.
Is it true, Mitya? How dare you? Am I for sale?
Panie, panie, yelled Mitya. She's pure and shining, and I've never been her lover. That's a lie.
How dare you defend me to him?
Shrieked Grushenka.
It wasn't virtue kept me pure, and it wasn't that I was afraid of Kuzma, but that I might hold up my head when I met him, and tell him he's a scoundrel. And did he actually refuse the money?
He took it, cried Mitya. Only he wanted to get the whole 3,000 at once, and I can only give him 700 straight off.
I see. He heard I had money and came here to marry me.
Pani Agrippina, cried the little Pole. I'm a knight. I'm a nobleman and not a lajtek. I came here to make you my wife, and I find you a different woman, perverse and shameless.
Oh, go back where you came from. I'll tell them to turn you out, and you'll be turned out,
cried Grushenka, furious.
I've been a fool to have been miserable these 5 years. And it wasn't for his sake, it was my anger made me miserable. And this isn't he at all. Was he like this? It might be his father. Where did you get your wig from? He was a falcon, but this is a gander. He used to laugh and sing to me, and I've been crying for 5 years. Damned fool, abject, shameless I was.
She sank back in her low chair and hid her face in her hands. At that instant the chorus of Mokroe girls began singing in the room on the left, a rollicking dance song.
A regular Sodom,
Vrublevsky roared suddenly.
Landlords, send the shameless hussies away.
The landlord, who had been for some time past inquisitively peeping in at the door, hearing shouts and guessing that his guests were quarrelling, at once entered the room.
"What are you shouting for? Do you want to split your throat?"
he said, addressing Vrublevsky with surprising rudeness.
"Animal!"
bellowed Pan Vrublevsky.
"Animal? And what sort of cards were you playing with just now? I gave you a pack and you hit it? You played with marked cards. I could send you to Siberia for playing with false cards, you know that? For it's just the same as false banknotes."
And going up to the sofa, he thrust his fingers between the sofa back and the cushion and pulled out an unopened pack of cards.
"Here's my pack, unopened."
He held it up and showed it to all in the room.
"From where I stood, I saw him slip my pack away and put his in place of it. You're a cheat and not a gentleman."
"And I twice saw the pan change a card," cried Kalganov. "How shameful! How shameful!"
exclaimed Grushenka, clasping her hands and blushing for genuine shame.
"Good Lord, he's come to that."
"I thought so, too," said Mitya.
But before he'd uttered the words, Vrublevsky, with a confused and infuriated face, shook his fist at Grushenka, shouting,
"You low harlot!"
Mitya flew at him at once, clutched him in both hands, lifted him in the air, and in one instant had carried him into the room on the right, from which they'd just come.
"I've laid him on the floor, there,"
he announced, returning at once, gasping with excitement.
"He's struggling, the scoundrel, but he won't come back, no fear of that."
He closed one half of the folding doors, and holding the other ajar, called out to the little Pole.
"Most illustrious, will you be pleased to retire as well?" "My dear Dmitri Fyodorovitch," said Trifon Borisovitch, "make them give you back the money you lost. It's as good as stolen from you."
"I don't want my 50 rubles back," Kalganov declared suddenly.
"I don't want my 200 either," cried Mitya. "I wouldn't take it for anything. Let him keep it as a consolation."
"Bravo, Mitya, you're a trump, Mitya," cried Grushenka.
And there was a note of fierce anger in the exclamation. The little Pan, crimson with fury, but still mindful of his dignity, was making for the door, but he stopped short and said, suddenly addressing Grushenka,
"Pani, if you want to come with me, come. If not, goodbye."
And swelling with indignation and importance, he went to the door. This was a man of character. He had so good an opinion of himself that after all that had passed, he still expected that she would marry him. Mitya slammed the door after him.
"Lock it," said Kalganov.
But the key clicked on the other side. They'd locked it from within.
"That's capital," exclaimed Grushenka relentlessly. "Serve them right."
Chapter 8. Delirium. What followed was almost an orgy, a feast to which all were welcome. Grushenka was the first to call for wine.
"I want to drink. I want to be quite drunk, as we were before. Do you remember, Mitya, do you remember how we made friends here last time?"
Mitya himself was almost delirious, a feeling that his happiness was at hand, but Grushenka was continually sending him away from her.
"Go and enjoy yourself. Tell them to dance, to make merry. Let the stove and cottage dance, as we had it last time," she kept exclaiming.
She was tremendously excited, and Mitya hastened to obey her. The chorus were in the next room. The room in which they had been sitting till that moment was too small, and was divided in two by cotton curtains, behind which was a huge bed with a puffy feather mattress and a pyramid of cotton pillows. In the four rooms for visitors there were beds. Grushenka settled herself just at the door. Mitya set an easy chair for her. She had sat in the same place to watch the dancing and singing the time before, when they'd made merry there. All the girls who had come had been there then. The Jewish band, with fiddles and zithers, had come too. And at last the long-expected cart had arrived with the wines and provisions. Mitya bustled about. All sorts of people began coming into the room to look on. Peasants and their women, who'd been roused from sleep and attracted by the hopes of another marvellous entertainment, such as they'd enjoyed a month before. Mitya remembered their faces, greeting and embracing everyone he knew. He uncorked bottles and poured out wine for everyone who presented himself. Only the girls were very eager for the champagne. The men preferred rum, brandy, and above all, hot punch. Mitya had chocolate made for all the girls, and ordered that 3 samovars should be kept boiling all night to provide tea and punch for everyone to help himself. An absurd, chaotic confusion followed, but Mitya was in his natural element, and the more foolish it became, the more his spirits rose. If the peasants had asked him for money at that moment, he would have pulled out his notes and given them away right and left. This was probably why the landlord, Trifon Borisovich, kept hovering about Mitya to protect him. He seemed to have given up all idea of going to bed that night, though he drank little, only 1 glass of punch, and kept a sharp lookout on Mitya's interests after his own fashion. He intervened in the nick of time, civilly and obsequiously persuading Mitya not to give away cigars and Rhine wine, and above all, money to the peasants, as he had done before. He was very indignant, too, at the peasant girls drinking liqueur and eating sweets. "They're a lousy lot, Dmitri Fyodorovich," he said. "I'd give them a kick, every one of them, and they'd take it as an honour. That's all they're worth." Mitya remembered Andrei again and ordered punch to be sent out to him. "I was rude to him just now," he repeated with a sinking, softened voice. Kalganov did not want to drink, and at first did not care for the girls singing. But after he drank a couple of glasses of champagne, he became extraordinarily lively, strolling about the room, laughing and praising the music and the songs, admiring everyone and everything. Maximov, blissfully drunk, never left his side. Grushenka, too, was beginning to get drunk. Pointing to Kalganov, she said to Mitya, "What a dear, charming boy he is." And Mitya, delighted, ran to kiss Kalganov and Maximov. "Oh, great," were his hopes. She'd said nothing yet, and seemed indeed purposely to refrain from speaking. But she looked at him from time to time with caressing and passionate eyes. At last she suddenly gripped his hand and drew him vigorously to her. She was sitting at the moment in the low chair by the door. "How was it you came just now, eh? How you walked in? I was frightened. So you wanted to give me up to him, did you? Did you really want to?"
"I didn't want to spoil your happiness," Mitya faltered blissfully. But she did not need his answer.
"Well, go and enjoy yourself," and sent him away once more. "Don't cry, I'll call you back again."
He would run away, and she listened to the singing and looked at the dancing, though her eyes followed him wherever he went. But in another quarter of an hour she would call him once more, and again he would run back to her.
"Come, sit beside me. Tell me, how did you hear about me and my coming here yesterday? From whom did you first hear it?"
And Mitya began telling her all about it, disconnectedly, incoherently, feverishly. He spoke strangely, often frowning, and stopped abruptly.
"What are you frowning at?" she asked.
"Nothing. I left a man ill there. I'd give 10 years of my life for him to get well, to know he was all right."
"Well, never mind him if he's ill. So you meant to shoot yourself tomorrow? What a silly boy, what for? I like such reckless fellows as you,"
she lisped, with a rather halting tongue.
"So you would go any length for me, eh? Did you really mean to shoot yourself tomorrow, you stupid? No, wait a little. Tomorrow I may have something to say to you. I won't say it today, but tomorrow. You'd like it to be today? No, I don't want today. Come, go along now, go and amuse yourself."
Once, however, she called him, as it were, puzzled and uneasy.
"Why are you sad? I see you're sad, yes, I see it,"
she added, looking intently into his eyes.
"Though you keep kissing the peasants and shouting, I see something. No, be merry. I'm merry, you be merry too. I love somebody here. Guess who it is? Ah, look, my boy has fallen asleep, poor dear, he's drunk."
She meant Kalganov. He was, in fact, drunk and had dropped asleep for a moment sitting on the sofa. But he was not merely drowsy from drink. He felt suddenly dejected, or, as he said, bored. He was intensely depressed by the girls' songs, which, as the drinking went on, gradually became coarse and more reckless. And the dances were as bad. 2 girls dressed up as bears, and a lively girl called Stepanida, with a stick in her hand, acted the part of keeper, and began to show them. "Look alive, Maria, or you'll get the stick." The bears rolled on the ground at last in the most unseemly fashion, amid roars of laughter from the closely packed crowd of men and women.
"Well, let them, said Grushenka sententiously, with an ecstatic expression on her face. "When they do get a day to enjoy themselves, why shouldn't folks be happy?"
Kalganov looked as though he'd been besmirched with dirt. "It's swinish, all this peasant foolery," he murmured, moving away.
"It's the games they play when it's light all night in summer."
He particularly disliked one new song to a jointy dance tune. It described how a gentleman came and tried his luck with the girls to see whether they would love him. The master came to try the girls. Would they love him, would they not? But the girls could not love the master. "He would beat me cruelly, and such love won't do for me." Then a gypsy comes along, and he too tries. The gypsy came to try the girls. Would they love him, would they not? But they couldn't love the gypsy either. "He would be a thief, I fear, and would cause me many a tear." And many more men came to try their luck. Among them a soldier. The soldier came to try the girls. Would they love him, would they not? But the soldier is rejected with contempt in two indecent lines, sung with absolute frankness and producing a furore in the audience. The song ends with a merchant. The merchant came to try the girls. Would they love him, would they not? And it appears that he wins their love because
the merchant will make gold for me, and his queen I'll gladly be.
Kalganov was positively indignant. "That's just a song of yesterday," he said aloud. "Who writes such things for them? They might just as well have had a railway man or a Jew come to try his luck with the girls. They'd have carried all before them." And almost as though it were a personal affront, he declared on the spot that he was bored, sat down on the sofa, and immediately fell asleep. His pretty little face looked rather pale as it fell back on the sofa cushion.
"Look how pretty he is," said Grushenka, taking Mitya up to him. "I was combing his hair just now. His hair's like flax and so thick."
And bending over him tenderly, she kissed his forehead. Kalganov instantly opened his eyes, looked at her, stood up, and with the most anxious air inquired, where was Maximov?
"So that's who it is you want," Grushenka laughed. "Stay with me a minute. Mitya, run and find his Maximov."
Maximov, it appeared, could not tear himself away from the girls, only running away from time to time to pour himself out a glass of liqueur. He had drunk two cups of chocolate. His face was red and his nose was crimson. His eyes were moist and mawkishly sweet. He ran up and announced that he was going to dance the Sabotiere. "They taught me all those well-bred aristocratic dances when I was little."
Go with him, Mitya, and I'll watch from here how he dances," said Grushenka. No, I'm coming to look on too,"
exclaimed Kalganov, brushing aside in the most naive way Grushenka's offer to sit with him. They all went to look on. Maximov danced his dance, but it roused no great admiration in anyone but Mitya, and consisted of nothing but skipping and hopping, kicking out the feet, and at every skip Maximov slapped the upturned sole of his foot. Kalganov did not like it at all, but Mitya kissed the dancer.
"Thanks.
You're tired, perhaps. What are you looking for here? Would you like some sweets, a cigar, perhaps?"
"A cigarette."
"Don't you want a drink?"
"I'll just have a liqueur."
"Have you any chocolates?" "Yes, there's a heap of them on the table there. Choose one, my dear soul." "I like one with vanilla, for old people." "No, brother, we've none of that special sort." "I say," the old man bent down to whisper in Mitya's ear, "that girl there, little Maria, how would it be if you were to help me make friends with her?" "So that's what you're after." "No, brother, that won't do." "I'd do no harm to anyone," Maximov muttered disconsolately. "Oh, all right, they only come here to dance and sing, you know, brother. But damn it all, wait a bit. Eat and drink and be merry, meanwhile. Don't you want money?" "Later on, perhaps," smiled Maximov. All right. Mitya's head was burning. He went outside to the wooden balcony which ran around the whole building on the inner side, overlooking the courtyard. The fresh air revived him. He stood alone in a dark corner and suddenly clutched his head in both hands. His scattered thoughts came together. His sensations blended into a whole and threw a sudden light into his mind. A fearful and terrible light.
"If I'm to shoot myself, why not now?" passed through his mind. "Why not go for the pistols, bring them here and here, in this dark, dirty corner, make an end?"
Almost a minute he stood undecided. A few hours earlier, when he'd been dashing here, he was pursued by disgrace, by the theft he'd committed. And that blood, that blood. But yet it was easier for him then. Then everything was over. He'd lost her, given her up. She was gone for him. Oh, then his death sentence had been easier for him. At least it had seemed necessary, inevitable. For what had he to stay on earth for? But now, was it the same as then? Now one phantom, one terror at least, was at an end. That first rightful lover, that fateful figure, had vanished, leaving no trace. The terrible phantom had turned into something so small, so comic. It had been carried into the bedroom and locked in. It would never return. She was ashamed, and from her eyes he could see now whom she loved. Now he had everything to make life happy. But he could not go on living, he could not.
Oh, damnation! Oh, God, restore to life the man I knocked down at the fence. Let this fearful cup pass from me. Lord, thou hast wrought miracles for such sinners as me. But what? What if the old man's alive? Oh, then, the shame of the other disgrace I would wipe away. I would restore the stolen money. I'd give it back. I'd get it somehow. No trace of that shame will remain except in my heart, forever. But no, no. Oh, impossible, cowardly dreams. Oh, damnation.
Yet there was a ray of light and hope in his darkness. He jumped up and ran back to the room. To her, his queen forever. Was not one moment of her love worth all the rest of life, even in the agonies of disgrace? This wild question clutched at his heart.
To her alone, to see her, to hear her, to think of nothing, to forget everything, if only for that night, for an hour, for a moment.
Just as he turned from the balcony into the passage, he came upon the landlord, Trifon Borisovitch. He thought he looked gloomy and worried and fancied he'd come to find him.
"What is it, Trifon Borisovitch? Are you looking for me?"
No, sir.
The landlord seemed disconcerted.
Why should I be looking for you? Where have you been?
Why do you look so glum? You're not angry, are you? Wait a bit. You shall soon get to bed. What's the time?
It'll be 3 o'clock. Past 3, it must be.
We'll leave off soon, we'll leave off.
Don't mention it, it doesn't matter. Keep it up as long as you like.
What's the matter with him?
Mitya wondered for an instant, and he ran back to the room where the girls were dancing. But she was not there. She was not in the blue room either. There was no one but Kalganov asleep on the sofa. Mitya peeped behind the curtain. She was there. She was sitting in the corner on a trunk, bent forward with her head and arms on the bed close by. She was crying bitterly, doing her utmost to stifle her sobs that she might not be heard. Seeing Mitya, she beckoned him to her, and when he ran to her, she grasped his hand tightly.
"Mitya, Mitya, I loved him, you know. How I have loved him these 5 years, all that time. Did I love him, or only my own anger? No, him. It's a lie that it was my anger I loved and not him. Mitya, I was only 17 then. He was so kind to me, so merry. He used to sing to me, or so it seemed to a silly girl like me. And now, O Lord, it's not the same man. Even his face is not the same. He's different altogether. I shouldn't have known him. I drove here with Timofey, and all the way I was thinking how I should meet him, what I should say to him, how we should look at one another. My soul was faint, and all of a sudden it was just as though he'd emptied a pail of dirty water over me. He talked to me like a schoolmaster, all so grave and learned. He met me so solemnly that I was struck dumb. I couldn't get a word in. At first I thought he was ashamed to talk before his great big Pole. I sat staring at him and wondering why I couldn't say a word to him now. It must have been his wife that ruined him. You know, he threw me up to get married. She must have changed him like that. Mitya, how shameful it is. Oh, Mitya, I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed for all my life. Curse it, curse it. Curse those 5 years.
And again she burst into tears, but clung tight to Mitya's hand and did not let it go.
Mitya, darling, stay, don't go away. I want to say one word to you, she whispered,
and suddenly raised her face to him.
Listen, tell me who it is I love. I love one man here. Who is that man? That's what you must tell me.
A smile lighted up her face that was swollen with weeping, and her eyes shone in the half-darkness.
A falcon flew in and my heart sank. Fool, that's the man you love. That was what my heart whispered to me at once. You came in and all grew bright. What's he afraid of, I wondered, for you were frightened, you couldn't speak. It's not them he's afraid of. Could you be frightened of anyone? It's me he's afraid of, I thought, only me. So, Fenya told you, you little stupid, how I called to Alyosha out of the window that I'd love Mityenka for 1 hour, and that I was going now to love another. Mitya, Mitya, how could I be such a fool as to think I could love anyone after you? Do you forgive me, Mitya? Do you forgive me or not? Do you love me? Do you love me?
She jumped up and held him with both hands on his shoulders. Mitya, dumb with rapture, gazed into her eyes, at her face, at her smile, and suddenly clasped her tightly in his arms and kissed her passionately.
You will forgive me for having tormented you. It was through spite I tormented you all. It was for spite I drove the old man out of his mind. Do you remember how you drank at my house one day and broke the wine glass? I remember that, and I broke a glass today and drank to my vile heart. Mitya, my falcon, why don't you kiss me? He kissed me once, and now he draws back and looks and listens. Why, listen to me. Kiss me. Kiss me hard. That's right. If you love, well, then love. I'll be your slave now, your slave for the rest of my life. It's sweet to be a slave. Kiss me. Beat me. Ill-treat me. Do what you will with me. And I do deserve to suffer. Stay. Wait. Afterwards. I won't have that.
She suddenly thrust him away.
Go along, Mitya. I'll come and have some wine. I want to be drunk. I'm going to get drunk and dance. I must. I must.
She tore herself away from him and disappeared behind the curtain. Mitya followed like a drunken man.
Yes. Come what may, whatever may happen now. For 1 minute I'd give the whole world, he thought.
Grushenka did, in fact, toss off a whole glass of champagne at one gulp, and became at once very tipsy. She sat down in the same chair as before, with a blissful smile on her face. Her cheeks were glowing, her lips were burning, her flashing eyes were moist. There was passionate appeal in her eyes. Even Kalganov felt a stir at the heart and went up to her.
"Did you feel how I kissed you when you were asleep just now?"
she said thickly.
"I'm drunk now. That's what it is. And aren't you drunk? And why isn't Mitya drinking? Why don't you drink, Mitya? I'm drunk and you don't drink."
"I am drunk. I'm drunk as it is, drunk with you. And now I'll be drunk with wine, too."
He drank off another glass, and he thought it strange himself. That glass made him completely drunk. He was suddenly drunk, although till that moment he'd been quite sober. He remembered that. From that moment everything whirled about him as though he were delirious. He walked, laughed, talked to everybody without knowing what he was doing. Only one persistent burning sensation made itself felt continually. "Like a red-hot coal in his heart," he said afterwards. He went up to her, sat beside her, gazed at her, listened to her. Chapter 3 Peasant Women Who Have Faith. Near the wooden portico below, built onto the outer wall of the precinct, there was a crowd of about 20 peasant women. They'd been told that the elder was at last coming out, and they'd gathered together in anticipation. Two ladies, Madame Holakov and her daughter, had also come out into the portico to wait for the elder, but in a separate part of it set aside for women of rank. Madame Holakov was a wealthy lady, still young and attractive, and always dressed with taste. She was rather pale and had lively black eyes. She was not more than 33 and had been 5 years a widow. Her daughter, a girl of 14, was partially paralysed. The poor child had not been able to walk for the last 6 months, and was wheeled about in a long reclining chair. She had a charming little face, rather thin from illness, but full of gaiety. There was a gleam of mischief in her big dark eyes with their long lashes. Her mother had been intending to take her abroad ever since the spring, but they had been detained all the summer by business connected with their estate. They had been staying a week in our town, where they had come more for purposes of business than devotion, but had visited Father Zosima once already, 3 days before. Though they knew that the elders scarcely saw anyone, they had now suddenly turned up again, and urgently entreated the happiness of looking once again on the great healer. The mother was seated on a chair by the side of her daughter's invalid carriage, and 2 paces from her stood an old monk, not one of our monastery, but a visitor from an obscure religious house in the far north. He, too, sought the elder's blessing. But Father Zosima, on entering the portico, went first straight to the peasants who were crowded at the foot of the 3 steps that led up into the portico. Father Zosima stood on the top step, put on his stole, and began blessing the women who thronged about him. One crazy woman was led up to him. As soon as she caught sight of the elder, she began shrieking and writhing, as though in the pains of childbirth. Laying the stole on her forehead, he read a short prayer over her, and she was at once soothed and quieted. I do not know how it may be now, but in my childhood I often happened to see and hear these possessed women in the villages and monasteries. They used to be brought to mass. They would squeal and bark like a dog, so that they were heard all over the church. But when the sacrament was carried in and they were led up to it, at once the possession ceased, and the sick women were always soothed for a time. I was greatly impressed and amazed at this as a child. But then I heard from country neighbours and from my town teachers that the whole illness was simulated to avoid work, and that it could always be cured by suitable severity. Various anecdotes were told to confirm this. But later on I learnt with astonishment from medical specialists that there is no pretense about it, that it is a terrible illness to which women are subject, especially prevalent among us in Russia, and that it is due to the hard lot of the peasant women. It is a disease, I was told, arising from exhausting toil, too soon after hard, abnormal, and unassisted labour in childbirth, and from the hopeless misery, from beatings and so on, which some women were not able to endure like others. The strange and instant healing of the frantic and struggling woman as soon as she was led up to the Holy Sacrament, which had been explained to me as due to malingering and the trickery of the clericals, arose probably in the most natural manner. Both the women who supported her and the invalid herself fully believed as a truth beyond question that the evil spirit in possession of her could not hold out if the sick woman were brought to the sacrament and made to bow down before it. And so, with a nervous and psychically deranged woman, a sort of convulsion of the whole organism always took place, and was bound to take place, at the moment of bowing down to the sacrament, aroused by the expectation of the miracle of healing, and the implicit belief that it would come to pass. And it did come to pass, though only for a moment. It was exactly the same now as soon as the elder touched the sick woman with the stole. Many of the women in the crowd were moved to tears of ecstasy by the effect of the moment. Some strove to kiss the hem of his garment, others cried out in sing-song voices. He blessed them all and talked with some of them. The possessed woman he knew already. She came from a village only 6 versts from the monastery, and had been brought to him before. "But here is one from afar." He pointed to a woman by no means old, but very thin and wasted, with a face not merely sunburnt, but almost blackened by exposure. She was kneeling and gazing with a fixed stare at the elder. There was something almost frenzied in her eyes.
From afar off, father, from afar off, from 200 miles from here. From afar off, father, from afar off.
The woman began in a sing-song voice as though she were chanting a dirge, swaying her head from side to side.